The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, dear friends, we're going to start today's conference on investment arbitration and human rights law. I want to welcome all of you who have come from far away and those who have come from the city and the United States. We're honored with your presence here, and we are very excited about your participation in this event. Let me say a couple of things first about the institution. We have in the spring numerous conferences and seminars in what we call our founders events. There are many reasons why we have founders events, conferences like this open to the broader public. And the first reason is that we're celebrating the creation of this law school every year. We were created in 1896 by two women, Ellen Spencer Massey and Emma Gillet, two women in a moment when women were not allowed to legal education and to the practice of the profession in the United States. And there are decisions by the different courts stating that women, by nature, were excluded from the study of law and the practice of the profession. We should take pause any time that somebody invokes nature to justify bigotry and intolerance, I would say. But in addition to that, the most positive lesson that can be drawn from that circumstance is the fact that our founding mothers believed that the study of the law and the application of the principles of the law were essential in order to achieve gender equality. That powerful message of our founding mothers is celebrated every year by addressing key issues facing the community, the nation, and the world, from business, human rights, the environment, and really reflecting this belief that the knowledge of the law and its principle is a powerful tool to achieve a society where individuals can develop themselves to the limit of their potential. As our founding mothers believe in that powerful tool, we continue that tradition. There is a second reason for these meetings. The strategic vision of this law school is that there is hardly an issue that lacks a legal component in today's issues facing humanity. And then we serve a public purpose when we highlight, analyze in a pluralistic environment those issues facing humanity, both for experts and the general public. And that allows then the general public to elevate their understanding of those issues and empowers them to participate creatively with more knowledge in the debates facing the society and the world. In addition to conferences by themselves, as you see here, we podcast and webcast what happens here, and then what you say is going to be seen and watched by thousands of human beings, so we need to alert you about that. So that you know that there is more relevance even to what you see here. So we have this, this law school was in the avant-garde in terms of podcasting in particular, the events that take place here. And we have sometimes tens of thousands of hits in the conferences that happen in the law school. This event is co-sponsored by the Center for International Environmental Law, CIEL, and we're proud of the association with CIEL. There was a time where universities were the only ones doing research and teaching and storing the results of their research in libraries. Now, with globalization, the creation of virtual space, and we don't have that division of labor that is so strict. Think tanks, governments, corporations, NGOs do training and do research. And, well, again, we have seen as part of the strategic development of the law school then to link ourselves with actors and subjects that traditionally were not considered as responsible for teaching and research. And one of those is CL, and we're very proud of the association with that institution, which is co-sponsoring today's event. Before I introduce Daniel Barstow Magro, the president of the Center for International Environmental Law, let me also recognize Susana Castiglioni, coordinator of the International Arbitration Program, for a tremendous effort in organizing this event. Thank you, Susana, for your work. I also would like to mention that the law school has developed different institutes or centers in order to provide specialized training in addition to the duty to provide excellent education to the graduate students in the JD, LLM, or PhD program, but offering in a new situation where time is an issue and people are in a need of constantly educating and re-educating themselves. So we have created this Center of International Commercial Arbitration, and Horacio Grigera Naon, who is here, is the director, founder of this center, and we're extremely pleased and grateful to the fact that we attracted someone with the creativity and knowledge of this area. The center develops seminars, specialized programs, and is in the process of developing perhaps one of the few LLMs that will take that exists in this area in the field of international commercial arbitration. Already there is tremendous enthusiasm and commitment by our students. I'm pleased to share with you that our team took first place in the second ICC International Mediation Competition in Paris, France, in February 2007. And you know, a limited field of school teams from around the world was selected to participate in the competition from Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, China, France, India, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom, in addition to the United States. Eight teams went to the quarterfinal round, five from the U.S., including Georgetown, Fordham, Hamline, Hastings, and 14 were selected for the semifinals, and at the end our school won. And the matter is not a matter of winning, even if it sounds good, but it's the participation and the work that is behind this, because this required a critical mass of courses, seminar, and commitment, and you see that working and working well, even if the best is yet to come, I would say. So this LLM in international law and LLM in international commercial arbitration. Well, I also want to thank Aurora Carmichael, who works in our Office of Special Projects, for her work in this important event, and the students that won the award, two students, Sebastian Astran and Whitney Robinson. Well, it's my pleasure now to introduce Daniel Magro, president of the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington, D.C. The center has offices in Washington, D.C. and Geneva. Mr. Magro was director of the International Environmental Law Office at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and he co-chaired the White House assessment of how genetically engineered organisms are regulated in the United States. He worked as an economist and business consultant in India, as a Peace Corps volunteer, was professor of law at the University of Colorado, practiced international civil rights and poverty law in Washington, D.C., and has been a very well-known arbitrator. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown and the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, things that we don't take against him, of course. And he has a degree from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was the editor-in-chief of the California Law Review and co-founder of the Berkeley Law Foundation, and a BA in economics from Harvard University, where he was a student body president. He has written numerous books and articles on a wide variety of subjects. So, Mr. Magro, thank you again, and we're very pleased to respond to you.
Thank you for that kind introduction. My job this morning is really very simple. It's first to welcome you all, both the regular participants and also the faculty. It's customary to congratulate the organizers for bringing together, always customary, to for bringing together a group of impressive speakers and well-qualified individuals. But this is truly a remarkable group of speakers that you have here today. For those of you who don't know, these are among the very leading arbitrators and intellectual leaders in arbitration in the world, as well as some of the leaders on human rights issues. So this is really a remarkable set of people, and I'm looking forward to hearing them. I want to thank the people at CL who did a lot of work on this, in particular Marcos Oriana, who is stuck in Chile right now because of a visa snafu. Sophia Plagakis and Lauren Baker and others at CL who worked on this, and all of you for coming, of course. It's very appropriate that we're having this at American University. It's one of a series of joint conferences that we hold. This is one of those conferences that makes use of the real expertise that American University has on human rights, on arbitration, and so we're very, very fortunate in that sense, too. I won't talk much now. I'm going to fill in for Marcos at the very end of the program and summarizing the comments of others. But I do want to say that to me, the legal issues that are raised by this interface, by this interrelationship, are really very profound. It's not just a matter of trying to fit these two together. There's some real questions about how they relate. And I am looking forward to hearing what our speakers have to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. So we, in order to get to a substance right away, as you know, we are very honored to have here Yoram Dinstein, Professor Emeritus of Tel Aviv University, Zachary Douglas, Professor of the University College London and Matrix Chambers, and Claudia Martin, Professor and Co-Director of the Academy on Human Rights and Humanitarian Law of the Law School. The first of our law school, the first topic in the afternoon is international human rights and investment law issues in international arbitration. We're going to get to the topics right away. The speakers will speak in the order that you see them sitting here for 10 minutes each, and then we will have time for questions. So it's my pleasure to offer Professor Dinstein the word first.
Thank you very much, Dean, ladies and gentlemen. Well, since I'm the first speaker, I have to, as it were, introduce the problem or the dilemma. And we have to split it. First of all, there is the issue of expropriation of the property of foreigners, or as I prefer calling it, together with some other scholars and commentators, deprivation rather than expropriation, because expropriation usually means, in the mind of most people, an expropriation order, something that is done de jure, clearly, explicitly, and in fact there is a de facto expropriation, which means that you interfere with the entitlement of the foreigner to enjoy his or her property, and therefore deprivation is probably a better term. Now, this has undergone a very interesting development in international law, because until the 1960s, the law was very clear, and it was encapsulated by the General Assembly in a resolution, famous resolution 1803, 1962, which sets the rules, as we all know it. Then there was a sort of a backlash of the USSR, which still existed, and developing countries. And in 1974, the General Assembly adopted a contradictory resolution. And all of a sudden, the sanctity of property is no longer recognized. The question arose which of the two resolutions reflects international law. And interestingly enough, in the famous Texaco arbitration, the French judge Dupuis ruled that 1803, the original resolution, is international law, and not the new resolution, the corrective introduced by the developing nations, by the Second World and the Third World combined. This was the decision. Again, interestingly enough, he has been completely corroborated by practice. If you take all the recent arbitral awards, starting from the U.S.-Iran claims process and ending with all of the arbitrations that relate to bilateral investment treaties, the BITs, about 2,000 of them, I think, by now, you will find that all of them corroborate the old law. So the old law has become, if you wish, an immovable target. You cannot change it. It's too late to change it. This is the law. What does the law mean? You cannot deprive a foreigner of property unless you meet three cumulative conditions. Condition number one, it has to be done. You can take the property, but you have to do it for public purpose. Which means that if the president or the chair of a junta in a dubiously democratic country, there are too many of them around, takes a ride in his car and sees a very nice villa which belongs to a foreigner, and he says to his aide, you know, I would like to live there, actually, and the villa is expropriated, forget about it. This is unlawful. That's number one. Number two, it's supposed to be non-discriminatory. Non-discriminatory compared to other foreigners, and non-discriminatory compared to local nationals. And number three, and above all, it has to be subject to full compensation. Yes, you can take it. Pay compensation. These are the three cumulative conditions. If you run afoul of even one of them, you've run afoul of international law as it stands today. So this is the immovable target. Now the second half of the equation, human rights. You know, I am the only one in the room who was present in the creation, in a sense. I was present in 1966 in the General Assembly when the two covenants on human rights were adopted. Not by acclamation, but they were adopted. Then in 1970, you know, there was a conference, 1968, there was a conference headed by the late Louis Sern, in which we adopted a resolution that 20 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we regard the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as customary international law. We were almost laughed out of court in 1968. It took the covenants 10 years to enter into force, and not by accident. I started a yearbook. It's by now the oldest yearbook anywhere on the planet on human rights. I started it in 1970. And again, many people wanted to know why I was wasting my time and my career, as it were, on an esoteric subject. Things have completely changed. Today, because of the immense contributions of various treaty bodies that have been established by sundry treaties, treaties galore, if you wish, because of the contribution of various NGOs, the so-called civil society, and so forth, human rights have practically become an irresistible force. We like to speak about the first generation of human rights, that's the civil and political rights, a second generation, which is more nebulous, less defined, but nevertheless binding, economic, social, and cultural rights. But there is talk about the third generation of human rights, like the right to an environment, the right to development, the right to peace, and so forth. And why not a fourth generation of human rights, a fifth generation of human rights? There is now talk about the human right to water, human right to everything. Now, this brings us to the old philosophical question and paradox. What happens when an irresistible force meets an immovable target? Because this is the situation. And it comes to light in a number of arbitrations that are taking place almost as we speak. I was hoping actually that one arbitral award will be available here. I don't see it on the table. It was given by an INSEAD panel headed by Horacio Gir, the famous, for me famous, TEDMEC case between Spain and Mexico. And I just want to take the facts, not necessarily anything else from that particular long, detailed, elaborate, and very enlightening award. And the facts are as follows. A Spanish company goes into Mexico and invests in a hazardous waste landfill. Now, at the time that it's doing it, this is regarded as completely, in fact, they are welcome to do it. You need a lot of professionalism and expertise in running such a landfill. But then things change. The local community doesn't like to have such landfill around. And they become aggressive about it. until finally, through the use of various political mechanisms available in the democracy, the government practically intervenes and closes down the landfill. And the relocation is not available for whatever reason. Now, you can see this is deprivation of property rather than expropriation, although they use the term expropriation, because it's de facto, it's not de jure. No title changed hand. It's not as if somebody took the stock of the company. It's just that the company wakes up one day and finds out that all that they have is a name, a shingle, because the landfill is closed. There's nothing that they can do. And the question then is, well, was it unlawful? Is it similar to a foreign investor coming into a country and investing in, let us say, in narco-trafficking, investing in prostitution, investing in gambling where it's unlawful? Certainly not. But perceptions have changed. Human rights have become rather dominant, certainly locally, and there is a human right to health. This is one of the economic, social, and cultural rights, which are binding, although not clearly defined. But one can certainly argue that the human right of the local community to health has been detrimentally affected by this landfill, which consists, as I mentioned before, of hazardous waste, and therefore it should be stopped, as it was. Okay, but the question is, how do you resolve it? Now, in my opinion, the resolution, and I'll cut to the chase because I have only 2 minutes, so I'll define it very clearly. As far as I'm concerned, yes, Mexico, through its various agencies, have the right to seize the property, to take the property. It was definitely for a public purpose, public good, the health of the local community. There was no serious charge that it was discriminatory. But we then come to the third issue, which is usually the $64 question in every expropriation / deprivation. That is, do you pay compensation? There is this, and I would like to tell you that I agree with them wholeheartedly. Because in my opinion, from a legal viewpoint, in order not to create an arbitrary sort of situation, that is the only fair and equitable resolution of the dilemma. Namely, you want to close the landfill? Fine. But in that case, everybody should share in the cost. The taxpayer, as it were, will share in the cost by paying compensation to the company. Because what is the alternative? The alternative is that only the investor company will bear the cost, and the local community will be happy. Its human right to life is fully protected, but it doesn't cost them a pretty penny. That will be unequitable and unfair in my viewpoint. So, to sum up, I think that the old law, that immovable target, remains very much in effect, and very much, in my opinion, in terms of its legal and even ethical validity. At the same time, if the government wishes to deprive the investor of its investment because the zeitgeist has changed, the mindset has changed, let them by all means take over the property, but let them put their money where their mouth is, pay compensation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Dinstein, now it's my pleasure to offer the word to Professor Zachary Douglas for 10 minutes or so.
Well, the audience is in luck because you have two speakers that don't agree on something. I've only got 10 minutes to disagree. It's probably not enough because there were some powerful things said, but I'll do my best. We've had the example of the villa being taken. Here's some other examples. Supposing that a foreign investor acquires its investments through the proceeds of crime, the state in question takes away the investment, seizes it, confiscates it. Does the state have to pay full compensation for that? I picked up this free newspaper across the road when I had my coffee at Starbucks. The title is Prosecutor, Local Private School Under Investigation, Sunrise Founder Suspected of Misusing Public Funds, Federal money for disturbed and disabled students may have gone towards stolen computers. I've got no idea what the status of schools is in this country. Maybe they're charitable organizations and therefore don't pay money to the stakeholders. I don't know. Assuming that they do, assuming this is a foreign investor that's invested in this school, the school is closed down. Full compensation has to be paid? What happens in the following example? What happens if there's an outbreak of an infectious disease among livestock? Happens all the time over in Europe, especially the United Kingdom. And in order to protect the health of people, because if this infectious disease spreads, a quick decision is made to slaughter a great number of livestock, which obviously has enormous economic repercussions for the communities involved. Obligation to pay full compensation. The difficulty, especially with the last one, which is perhaps the most contentious of those examples, is that a state official sometimes cannot be forced to be in a position to weigh up the full cost-benefit analysis of interfering with foreign or even domestic property rights. In some circumstances, a state official has to act quickly because the competing obligations upon the state in relation to protecting life or otherwise are further up the hierarchy of rights than the right to property. The fundamental thing to remember about property is that there is no such thing to absolute ownership. There's no such thing as to the complete sanctity of property in any legal jurisdiction. It just simply doesn't exist. You have, in every jurisdiction, you have property limitation rules. I can't burn toxic waste on my residential property, for example. You have property independent rules which dictate certain uses or non-uses of property. There are certain things I cannot do with a knife, for example. In every jurisdiction you have expropriation and appropriation rules. And in most jurisdictions those rules mean that you have to pay compensation. But that doesn't mean that any interference with property is subject to full compensation. It's certainly not the case in perhaps the most developed legal system in the world in relation to the taking of property, which happens to be the one we're in. The jurisprudence out of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, the academic writing, is probably second to none in its sophistication. And yet there is widespread agreement. In fact, I don't think it's particularly controversial that just compensation under the Fifth Amendment does not mean an indemnity with respect to any effect of state interference with the property. The Americans have taken a very pragmatic view of this. And the reason is, obviously, that if you subject any state interference to full compensation, then that will have a chilling effect. That will mean that in certain circumstances, the right to life, the right to healthy family life, perhaps, that you can imagine all sorts of circumstances, that's going to have a chilling effect because priority will have to be given to the right to property. And in legal instruments where they do regulate the spectrum of rights, such as the European Convention of Human Rights, you'll find that in Article 15, for example, in relation to derogation, you can derogate from a whole number of rights, but you can't derogate from the right to life, the prohibition of torture, prohibition of slavery, and rights like that. You can derogate from the right to property, and that evidences this hierarchy that I was talking about. And so in no system, domestic or international, is the right to property absolute. And the way that you can conceptualize this limitation within the investment treaty context is through the doctrine of the police powers. One of the unfortunate things about the rapid development of investment treaty law is that we've become very sophisticated about talking about regulatory expropriations and all the subtle ways that a state can interfere with investors' rights. And that is an excellent advance, don't get me wrong. When you have more and more public services privatized, it's essential that we have a more nuanced view of what state interference can mean, and we have mechanisms to cope with that and compensate for it. But at the same time, what hasn't happened is that the old customary international law doctrine of police powers hasn't undergone the same either intellectual or judicial development. And so in quite a recent case, which I was acting as counsel, called Saluka against the Czech Republic, the tribunal had to refer to the old text of the Harvard draft on articles of the Protection of Aliens' Rights back in 1961 for its definition of police powers. And if you look at that definition, it makes no reference to human rights, it makes no reference to the environment, and it's not, wouldn't come as a huge surprise. We just heard how modern and recent our current understanding of the human rights and the environment are. So it's no shock to the system that back in 1961 this wasn't the forefront of the drafters' minds. But that doesn't mean that the police powers doctrine can't and should not develop alongside our more expansive notions of regulatory expropriation. And if we do develop the police powers doctrine, there has to be recognition of some circumstances where when you have a conflict between human rights norms and the right to property, in some circumstances, but not all, the right to property is going to have to give way. It can give way in two different circumstances. Either it means that partial compensation is payable, or in some circumstances, as per the examples I gave at the start, it will mean that no compensation is paid. So there are three responses to potential interferences with property under an investment treaty. There is full compensation, which I would submit is payable only where there is no public purpose, where the taking has been made in bad faith. And that was the original justification for full compensation, as on an indemnity or restitutionary basis. That's the Charles L. Fatry case. That was an unlawful expropriation. These days it's applied to any taking, and I would submit that that is wrong. The second possibility is partial compensation, as the jurisprudence of the US Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights makes clear. In many circumstances, partial compensation is appropriate. Finally, there are circumstances, and I gave you a few examples, of where no compensation is appropriate because it is within the particular taking is within the police powers doctrine. Now, the difficult cases, some of which I'm involved with on behalf of Argentina, are where you have a clash between the right to property as it's protected by an investment treaty and other rights such as the right to water. Now, in some circumstances, I think the distinction is going to be if the right to water, one can imagine a circumstance where the right to water or the lack of a right to water slowly merges into the right to life, i.e. if you don't have one then you don't have the latter. In those circumstances where urgent action on the part of the state is required, that may well be within the police powers doctrine and that may well justify state interference with property without compensation. In circumstances where the state has time, it has resources, and it can make an assessment of the cost-benefit, or can give a cost-benefit analysis of interfering, then one would expect that partial compensation would be justified because it's not an emergency situation that justifies quick action. If the state action is devoid of a public purpose, if it's really an expropriation dressed up as some sort of intervention to protect the right to water, then obviously full compensation is clearly justified. And the investor should recover full compensation on a restitutionary basis. I believe that I've got to the end of my 10 minutes, but we'll certainly take questions afterwards.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. And last but not the least, Claudia Martin.
Thank you very much, Dr. Osman. My presentation today will focus on the a more practical view of the relationship between arbitration and human rights. For numbers of years, I have been observing a certain overlapping of international jurisdictions that deal and create competing international obligations for states. I think that arbitral jurisdictions and human rights jurisdictions are a very good example to analyze and explore these overlapping international jurisdictions and the consequences of the competing international obligations that are created for states. When I speak about arbitral jurisdiction, I'm thinking about arbitral tribunals created mainly under BITs or regional trade agreements that are created mainly to adjudicate on investor states' disputes. And when I speak about human rights tribunals, I'm going to concentrate mainly on the Inter-American system, for a number of reasons. Number one, I know the system better than the other systems. And number two, there are very interesting features of the Inter-American system that make the analysis more compelling and interesting. The first feature I would say is that the Inter-American system makes a very extensive use of what is called preliminary measures, either precautionary measures or provisional measures. The provisional measures in the Inter-American system are binding, and I think that that's an important difference as compared to other international human rights tribunals. Number two, the practice of reparations awarded by the Inter-American Court are very innovative as compared to other international tribunals as well. The Inter-American Court awards reparation not only in regard to compensation, but also in regard to other non-compensatory measures. For example, in many cases, the court has been willing to award reparations in regard to laws or constitutions or in requesting the state to create particular funds to support housing rights for the victims of the particular case. Number three, and that's another important feature, there are a number of cases that have been brought to the Inter-American system regarding extractive cases arising out of the so-called extractive industry, mainly oil exploration and exploitation, and also mining, cases related to the mining industry. So for all these three reasons, I think that the Inter-American system is a very good model to analyze the overlapping between these international jurisdictions, human rights, and arbitration. Though there are no particular cases decided as of today where the creation of competing obligations has happened, there are a number of cases that have been currently processed by the Inter-American system, and I would like to choose one of them to exemplify the analysis that I like to propose today. This is the so-called Sarayaku case. It is a case regarding the Quechua peoples of the Sarayaku community, an indigenous community in Ecuador. In 1982, this community received a full title of ownership to the ancestral lands that they have claimed for a number of years. After that, in 1996, Ecuador entered into a partnership contract with an Argentine company to carry out all exploration and exploitation in a number of areas of the country. One of these areas, the so-called Block 23, involved part of the ancestral lands of the community. The decision to enter into a contract was made without any consultation or without obtaining any consent from the community. Of course, the decision to start exploration and exploitation of oil in the community created turmoil within the community, and as a result of that, there were a lot of violent events that took place, and several members of the communities were subject to detention, torture, and other related violations. Since the problem was not resolved at the local level, there was a decision by a lower court issuing an injunction to stop the exploration in the ancestral lands, but that, of course, has happened in many countries. The decision of the lower court was never respected. The petitioners in this case decided to bring the case to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. In that particular case, they argued, among other things, a violation of Article 21, which is the right to property. In the Inter-American system, the right to property has been interpreted as broader than private property. The Inter-American Court in the famous Agostini case decided that property under the American Convention protects not only private and individual property in the sense of the liberal tradition, but also the property of indigenous communities to ancestral land. So the case was mainly was brought to the system mainly to argue violation of this Article 21 in addition to the other violations that included the right to freedom, personal liberty, and the right not to be subject to torture. The Inter-American Commission decided to issue precautionary measures, requesting the state to stop the exploration until and after a final decision in the case was made. Since the state did not comply with those precautionary measures, the commission removed and requested provisional measures from the court. The court decided to issue those measures. Although it never said that the state had an obligation to stop the exploration, it did request the state to take any measure to protect all the rights affected to the community, which again included the right to property. The other important thing in the decision of the Inter-American Court is that it interpreted under the American Convention there is an ever-only obligation of the state to protect the rights of the individuals under each jurisdiction, not only in regard to the actions of the state, but also in regard to private action. And therefore, it included mainly the action of the company. The case has not been decided yet. However, the Commission has issued a decision on admissibility, and as far as I know, there is a process of firm settlement in place at this point. But let's assume that this case continues and there's a final decision by the Commission and later by the Court finding a violation of Article 21 of the American Convention. As a result of that particular decision, there's a possibility that the Court will request the state to stop exploration and to involve the community in the renegotiation of the terms of the contract, particularly to take into account what the community expects the contract to be performed in regard to their ancestral lands. In that particular case, what will happen is that the company, of course, will be affected in its property rights. Though I haven't been able to gather much information on what is the current status of the company, or what is the company, the actions that the company is taking about this particular situation, I understand that there is a waiting period. But let's think now that, assuming there is a decision by the Inter-American Court requesting the stop of the exploration, that the company decides that it will withdraw from the project and that it will take this case to an arbitral tribunal. There is, in fact, a VAT in place between Argentina and Ecuador. I don't know exactly the terms of the treaty, but let's assume that it provides for arbitration as a dispute settlement. Let's assume again that the arbitral tribunal decides in favor of the company and that awards compensation to the company for the violation of the right to property. In this particular case, Ecuador will be facing two different decisions from two international tribunals, in essence requesting the state to take contradictory action. It's interesting to see that, as you all know, there's no precedent in international law, and therefore it's impossible to say that the decision of the Inter-American Court should prevail over the decision of the International Arbitration Tribunal or the other way around. Therefore, in such a situation, Ecuador will be faced with a situation of competing international obligation. They will have to decide how to address this particular case. It's interesting to see that, talking to a colleague that I think is here from Ecuador, I was asking him what is his perception of how the state would respond. And he told me, the sense is that the state would prefer to go with the cheapest option. And of course, if we compare compensation between the Inter-American Court and the compensation that could be awarded by an international tribunal, violating of the rights of the indigenous communities would be the cheapest option in this case. Since I don't want to be so cynical, I think that we should all think that we are at the point that we have to address the intersection between human rights and arbitration from a different point of view. And that therefore, one option could be that either the Inter-American Court or the arbitral tribunal had to take into account the decision of the other tribunal when balancing out the decision that they will make in the particular case. Unfortunately, as it works now, the decisions are made in a parallel way, but without taking into consideration what the other court or the other tribunal is doing. So again, I guess that we have an issue there to be discussed, but I need to raise it because I believe that it's current and that the state, particularly in this hemisphere, will have to face these two competing international obligations coming from different international tribunals. I leave it there and then I'll be happy to answer other questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you, the three speakers, for their presentations and for being within the time, and I would like to offer the floor for comments, criticism, and so forth and so on. Please indicate your name and affiliation. As are you leaving, or you want to ask a question? Okay, good.
Well, she's leaving.
Good. That was good timing, I would say, to create the sense of, well, while you think about questions, let me offer a few comments. Let me see. Up until the Second World War, there was basically a debate between the theory of the minimum standard and the theory of non-discrimination, particularly in this hemisphere. Foreign investors, and not only in relation with the protection of property, but also other human rights, the right to life, the prohibition of torture and inhumane treatment, due process, and so forth. But the countries, I would say, that were exporting capital, defended the theory of the minimum standard of treatment. That people, foreigners, should be treated in accordance with the minimum standard. And the minimum standard of treatment, there were some different concepts, but in terms of property, generally speaking, property required adequate, prompt, and effective compensation for its protection. The Third World, and in that time the Third World were the Latin American countries mostly, raised the issue of non-discrimination. Foreigners are entitled only to non-discriminatory treatment. And again, a proof of discrimination was a denial of justice. And again, there were different ideas of denial of justice, but certainly not having access to the court and flagrant violations of due process could create international liability. Now, I think both theories show their shortcomings. In the theory of a minimum standard, the way in which you treated or mistreated your own citizens didn't matter. And that was the reason, I mean, and again, all these were not only theoretical questions. The Second World War showed that the mistreatment of nationals could not simply be ignored by anyone, and that the international system that did not encompass the treatment of citizens and nationals would even endanger world peace in many ways, because a government that was ready to commit genocide or kill their own citizens could not be trusted, but also because of interconnectedness, the idea that you can violate every human right but not the rights of foreigners, somehow in life showed that it was not any longer tenable, and there needed to be something that encompasses both. The theory of non-discrimination also said, if I mistreat my own nationals, I can mistreat foreigners. I mean, so again, that did not do justice to expectations of decency. And so after the Second World War, as these things happens, because they didn't function in reality, we came up with the International Bill of Rights. And that was, it's a process still in development, because first, the standard of achievement. I mean, countries were not prepared to say these were legal norms. Then we moved to legal norms, and then the most very interesting thing, supervisory mechanisms and institutions that were semi-judicial and judicial. Because again, we have these norms, but horizontal supervision, meaning other countries will exercise protection. Well, countries might exercise protection because of economic, political reasons. They might be more powerful, less powerful. So the whole idea is we need also institutions that would supervise compliance with the human rights that carry nationals and foreigners. And second thing, we would like independent experts, judges, arbiters, and so forth. They don't take orders from anyone. And the right of access to individuals themselves. And I think we're in that process now. I think also that that extension of content and changing also the supervisory organ had an impact in the protection of property, in many ways also taking into account a new, not only we're talking about foreigners, we're talking about nationals, and also the understanding of complex situations. Let me give an example. We have one possibility. We have you know, widows that put money on the side every month and create a company, and people that are entrepreneurial and honest go and buy things, and then nationalist, you know, thieves go and capture their property because they're jealous. That's a model that can happen in life. But there are other models also. A model, for example, of a company that will go to a country and corrupt the legal system of the country. And by politicians, by exemptions, and oh, in this region there are so many examples that we can spend the whole day talking about. So that model also needs to be taken into account in the law of compensation. We cannot just say, well, this is a matter that cannot affect or have an impact in the way in which we protect the property. Or we have the rights of indigenous population. I was the president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. I had to handle the Aguastingui case. The Aguastingui had lived since time immemorial in property. The Constitution of Nicaragua said that they were entitled to their property, their ancestral properties, where they traditionally fish and hunt. And they say a law will regulate their titles of property, except that Nicaragua never regulated that. And then the government gave a concession to a South Korean company, Solcarsa, to operate in the lands of the Indian community and cut the trees. And again, in the law preceding the Second World War, they wouldn't have anything to do. Now they went to the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Court. And the Inter-American Commission Court based the protection of property in international law. And in Article 27 of the American Convention, and say the title of property is based in international. So there are different models. In this case, for example, perhaps they were, because of this decision, affecting Solcarsa, a South Korean company that had that certain investment. And somebody could say, well, that's the responsibility of their own government, except that also that needs to be investigated. Because there is a responsibility by accepting a bribe and also by offering a bribe. And the traditional law of compensation cannot ignore the clean hands. No. And there also I would say the following. This emphasis in human rights cannot ignore also that a national government, because of political issues, sometimes could lie as to the presence of foreign property and could attempt to affect the foreign property, you know, arguing anything, you know. And there is where I think that arbitration plays a very important role. Because you see, I mean, what I have seen evolving, but that's my opinion from the human rights field, that adequate, prompt, and effective compensation remain as a very important guideline, but we need some body that takes into account, trying to achieve that goal, all the complexities of a given situation for the purposes of achieving justice. And the complexities of a situation involve an assessment of corruption, an assessment of, you know, and again, this is law now. There is an Inter-American Convention on Corruption. So, because if somebody could have said in the past, well, you know, if your government is corrupt, it's your business. Now, as we have established in international law human rights, we have established in international law that narco-trafficking, funding terrorism, and exercising all the things that constitute corruption also is an international matter. So it doesn't matter whether the domestic legal system, you know, didn't comply with these things. We have an international base, as it happened in Aguastingui, that investors and individuals should be aware of. So, but there is where I see also issue of arbitration, because governments too easily, you know, could be tempted to abuse, you know, the context for the purpose of justifying deprivation of property. And the only way to solve that problem is by having independent people that will take a look at the circumstances and probably guide, but that principle that property could not be taken away, and if you take away adequate, prompt, and effective, that's fine, but we were going to look at all the circumstances to see how that principle should be applied against it. So there is where I see some the interest role of arbitration, and international adjudication and the intersection between human rights and protection of property. But that's something to stimulate discussion, as the most daring of you are ready to ask questions. Yes, please. So we start again then. No.
Well, it's in my interest to say that the system shouldn't be taken down and dismantled, because I do quite well out of it. I'm very active, acting as counsel in these various cases. But by the same token, it is true to say that the lack of transparency, I think in particular in the appointment of arbitrators, is starting to become a problem. I don't think it's necessarily a problem of substantive law. I think there's enough scope within investment treaties as they are drafted to incorporate precisely some of the suggestions I'm making. There is nothing in an investment treaty which prohibits the application of the police powers doctrine, and it has been applied by the tribunal that I mentioned. When you're trying to determine what fair and equitable treatment means, for example, which is a ubiquitous obligation in most investment treaties, you can certainly have recourse to other principles and rules of international law, and human rights treaties would be one source of inspiration in determining what fair and equitable means. So in terms of substantive law, I don't share the very cynical view that you do see from time to time, that basically you need to rewrite all these treaties or denounce them and start all over again. I don't think that's the case. I think there's, for arbitrators with enough imagination, so long as they're taking a balanced approach, there is more than enough, there are more than enough gaps, you could say, in the investment treaty framework to read it in a way which is sustainable. And I guess that one of the major considerations, if the, one of the trends which is one can see from the awards at the moment, whereby any sort of deprivation is fully compensated regardless of the circumstances, there will come a time when states just simply, because of the chilling effect on their regulatory activity, will simply withdraw from these treaties. And I think that would be quite a disaster for the international rule of law. Whatever you think about these treaties, it's absolutely the case that they do foster, I guess you would say, bureaucratic discipline. These days, before someone is about to seize that villa on the way to the airport or whatever, they think twice if they've signed bilateral investment treaties or what have you. So the little person in the judicial department or whatever who says, but, Sir, President, Mr. President, whatever, if you do this, there's going to be an arbitration. That little person has a lot more, has a much stronger voice than he did 50 years ago. So it does impose discipline on executive decision making. So I would say at the moment, I would say that the biggest problem is really in the transparency in the appointment of arbitrators. And without getting too cynical, you have too many situations where investors appoint certain arbitrators time and time again because they can be counted on to render a certain type of decision, and you have states who appoint certain arbitrators time and time again. And that's a real shame. There shouldn't be two camps who advocate interests of one or the other parties. But unfortunately, that seems to be the direction that it's going, which, as I say, is a great shame.
Good. Yes. It does if you turn it on. In other words, I always appreciate considerations of social engineering on how treaties should be or how the arbitrator should find solutions. But the truth of the matter is that we arbitrators were confronted with legal texts. And these are treaties
And I think that really the presentations of Professor Dinstein and Professor Douglas go to the core of the matter. So Professor Dinstein has referred to the hardcore letter of the treaty. You expropriate, the treaty doesn't say a word about police powers. It says you have to pay compensation. Professor Douglas has laid a great emphasis, I think, on the police powers of the state. How do we factor this into the treaty? Are we saying, for instance, that there is a use Colvin's principle of international law that forces arbitrators to take into account these police powers, although they are not spelled out in the treaty? Are we saying, on the contrary, that police powers should be exercised, but however, the level of compensation is really the element that helps understand what the limits are? For instance, if the exercise of police powers leads to such a level of compensation that the state is prevented from exercising the police powers, is that the real limit? Professor Douglas referred to the situation of the cattle that is exterminated because of a disease, and that the state has to take certain measures to kill the cattle. Are we really talking about police powers or force majeure? So I'm putting all of these issues to the panel to see what their reactions may be.
Well, first of all, I have to respond to Professor Douglas, because speaking ahead of him, I was at a disadvantage. And obviously, we completely disagree. Mind you, I'm the one who started by pointing out that if the investment goes into an illegal enterprise, and I mentioned narco-trafficking, I mentioned prostitution, I mentioned gambling where it's unlawful, then obviously, if expropriation takes place, the investor cannot expect any compensation, because the investor should not have been there in this illegal undertaking in the first place. However, when we are talking about the culling of cattle because of the mad cow disease, for example, this goes to the heart of the matter. Surely society has a right to cull the cattle, and in fact maybe to slaughter all of them. We now have the problem, or we thought that we had a major problem of the avian flu, and everybody took it for granted that in fact maybe every fowl within the jurisdiction will have to be slaughtered. What can you do? But the question is, who should bear the financial burden? And my position is very simple: society at large, not the farmer. You have to pay the farmer full compensation, and then it will spread among the taxpayers, and since the farmer himself or herself is also a taxpayer, he or she will also bear part of the cost, but a fair and equitable part of the cost. And others will bear most of the cost. It's not the fault of the farmer that there is a worldwide epidemic. And this relates to other issues as well. Professor Grossman has raised a new matter. There is now, incidentally, a United Nations Treaty on Corruption. So corruption is now regarded, indeed, as an internationally unlawful undertaking. And therefore, if a big corporation, the way Lockheed was infamous for doing it many years ago, I'm not suggesting that they're doing it now, I'm sure that they've learned from their experience. But if you take the Lockheed story as an example, if a company would behave the same way today, as far as I'm concerned, no compensation should be paid. On the contrary, that company should be taught a lesson. But, and here is the problem, if you don't mind my saying so with respect, Dean, some of what you said, and I agree with it, historically was anachronistic. Because you have to bear in mind, this has nothing to do with human rights, excuse me. This goes back to almost the dawn of international law. It's not a human right, it's the right of a foreign state. It's called in international law diplomatic protection of the nationals of the foreign country. But nothing to do with right to property or anything like that. When the property was expropriated, you did not run afoul of a human right of the investor. You ran afoul of the rights of a sovereign state. And it was up to the sovereign state to actually initiate proceedings, go to diplomatic protection, and if there were, at the time it was not clear at all, an arbitration agreement, you would end up with arbitration. And mind you, if you take a look at the original set of international arbitral awards published by the UN long ago, I'm not talking about the new volumes, I'm talking about the original, say, 15 volumes. Most of them relate to diplomatic protection. This was most of the business of international law throughout the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. Because there were so many arbitrations, and usually in deep with Latin American countries. In the United States and Mexico alone, there were hundreds. But also with Chile, with Venezuela, and so forth. Now, the Latin Americans rebelled, and rebelled, if you don't mind my saying so, in a very counterproductive way. Because not only did they lose the bad fight, as I mentioned before, because today the law is a return to what it used to be in the past, but they have failed in terms of not letting sleeping dogs lie. Because a country like the United States, the investing country, started to say, excuse me, if that's the case, we are not going to invest. So what have the Latin Americans almost done? They killed the goose that lays the golden egg. So there are no investments. Who is investing in Cuba today? Why should you? Except those who think that Castro is a mortal like everybody else, and therefore perhaps it's time to start investing in the post-Castro Cuba. But otherwise, who would be crazy to go to a country where you know that your money can be totally confiscated, and I'm using now the term confiscation deliberately, because it's without any compensation. So the United States actually initiated the whole trend of BITs. You know that? You want investments? Terrific. Sign on the dotted line. Bilateral investment treaty. You don't like it? There will be no investments. But you do want investment, so please sign. And those treaties are more explicit than anything that was done in the 19th century. And this is why today full compensation is beyond dispute. And it's very interesting to see the, especially the Iran-US claims world, where they made short shrift of all attempts that are even reflected. If you take a look at the famous restatement of the American Law Institute that was published, the third edition in this country, where important scholars headed by Neil Hankin of Columbia University tried actually to confine compensation from full to only just. And the State Department went full blast against the whole statement, which they regarded as totally tainted because of this totally unacceptable sentence on one single article in a series of more than one volume. But when you look at the BITs are all referred to full compensation. And if you take a look at the arbitral award that they are issuing, they have no doubt that they have to be full compensation. Now, admittedly, when you measure, when you assess full compensation, you take an interest in the circumstances of the case. And I do not have to tell you full compensation means one thing in a certain set of circumstances, something different in a different set of circumstances. Because what's full compensation? You can how do you define it? So you may define it as full market value. Okay, full market value, then take his lengthy decision. Full market value, then full market value when this was a going concern and they were making a lot of money, or full market value when the value is zero, or full market value at any time in between. You have lots of problems here. So you can say yes, full compensation, and yet it's not so full. And on the other hand, you can say, well, it's only just compensation. And in the view of many, many observers, it's full compensation. So there are no hard and fast rules here. It's all based on appraisal. It's all based on the human element. But don't confuse it with human rights. Human rights did not exist until the late 1940s. And you were right in pointing out to the World War II, if you wish, break in human arms, because it was only post-World War II that human rights started to develop. And it's by no means a coincidence that Human Rights Day is the day of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is December 10, 1948. And you read the Universal Declaration of 1948, it doesn't say this is the law.
It says this is the standard that you should strive to achieve. And this is why, as I mentioned earlier, rather briefly, when 20 years later, some of us started to say it's already customary international law, the majority didn't accept it as late as 1968. So human rights law is a very recent development. Don't talk about right to property here. Right to property is a different matter altogether. And it's only in the context of the European Convention of Human Rights and its protocol. As you know, the right to property does not appear in the original convention. It appears in a separate protocol. And of course in the American Convention. But if you read again the judgment of the European Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights goes for full compensation, subject again to what I said before, to the interpretation of what is full compensation. So please don't regard it at all. This is completely ahistorical, incorrect, and unacceptable to say right to property against right to life. We are not talking about right to property. We are talking about the right of a sovereign state to diplomatic protection of its nationals. And now with the new BITs, this has been translated into the ability of a company to go directly to some sort of an arbitral tribunal, such as INSEAD and so forth, and to insist on those rules being implemented and enforced in a very efficacious way. But historically, don't link what's not linkable.
Professor
Dagler? One more sentence. You know, there was a Latin American international lawyer, Garcia Amador, you'll remember the name, who tried to link the two within the context of the war that went on forever in the International Law Commission on State Responsibility. He was totally rejected. And as you know, the commission has finally submitted its text to the General Assembly, which took note. You do not have there a scintilla, a shadow of the original thinking of Garcia Amador. It was completely rejected. This has nothing to do with human rights.
Right. I suspect you're not having a problem hearing us anymore. On the investment treaty side, and where does police powers fit in and human rights obligations? And can we even talk about this if it's not expressly referred to? The fact is that investment treaties are part of the international legal system. Customary international law affects the interpretation of the obligations. Customary international law fills in the gaps. No tribunal has any problem referring to the ILC's articles on state responsibility. No tribunal has any problem in referring to the Charles R. Fattrey standard of compensation. No tribunal has any problem in referring to diplomatic protection cases with respect to what expropriation means. So all these treaties are read in a much wider context than the specific provisions that they contain, and that isn't particularly controversial. As I said, there have been tribunals already who have referred to the police powers doctrine, and it has to be referred to because it has never, ever been an expropriation, for example, to levy taxation on an investment, to confiscate assets if they've been purchased through the proceeds of crime, to destroy an investment through a change in interest rate or currency devaluation. These things have never been an expropriation, and so in determining what an expropriation is, it's completely natural and I would say obligatory to refer to what that term of art means in customary international law. You simply can't take that test, and which is derived from customary international law and certainly has a long history, and read it as if you can only interpret those words in absolute splendid isolation. With respect to the Mao-Kao disease example, it's quite a useful one because it tends to generate differing opinions. There actually has been a case on this very point before the European Courts of Human Rights. It was the Pinnacle against the United Kingdom case. They had an investor who was an investor. It was a domestic investor who had invested a lot of money in purchasing highly sophisticated cattle head bone extraction machinery, and the materials extracted from the head of the cows were shipped to meat processing companies. And during the mad cow disease epidemic, the UK government decided that it was simply too dangerous to engage in this activity anymore. that case got to the European Convention, the European Court of Human Rights, and they relied upon Article 1, Protocol 1, the protection of property, and they received no compensation. Their whole business was destroyed. No compensation for future income, no compensation for all the machinery that was purchased. Now, that might seem to be a harsh result, but for the reasons I've alluded to, if there was an obligation of full compensation rather than partial compensation, but if there was an obligation for full compensation, you could imagine what would happen in circumstances like that. The UK government would have thought very long and hard before it decided to take its measures, and in the interim period, perhaps the situation would have become a lot worse. So there are circumstances where the chilling effect of full compensation is just simply untenable, given the state's other obligations to its citizens. And these, it's very relevant to look at human rights obligations in the same context as investment treaty obligations. And the reason it's very relevant is that these things can collide, and you have to sort out the problem when they do. The European Court of Human Rights has already heard two cases, one against Spain, one against Italy, where those two states were found to be in breach of the Human Rights Convention because they had failed to prevent private companies from polluting. And as a result of the pollution, certain nationals in the vicinity of the factories had suffered serious health degradation. Now, that's already happened. And an investment treaty tribunal cannot simply ignore the competing responsibilities of the state. This is certainly part of the law of expropriation. It always has been. It's certainly part of trying to establish what fair and equitable treatment means. You can't look at these obligations purely and simply through the eyes of the investor. That's never been the case. Either in customary international law, the IRS Claims Tribunal, or any other forum. In terms of the standard of compensation, whether it's acceptable ever to have partial compensation, I hope I've made out the case that in certain circumstances, no compensation is the only appropriate response. And the example where property is obtained through the proceeds of crime, or a school shut down because it hasn't, it's misspent public funds or something of that nature. Clearly no compensation is due in those circumstances. But as for partial compensation, and this is the position both under the European Convention of Human Rights and the Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, the European Court of Human Rights has made it clear, and I'll quote for you if you like. This is in the case of James against the United Kingdom. Legitimate objectives of public interest, such as those pursued in measures of economic reform or measures designed to achieve greater social justice, may call for less than reimbursement of the full market value. That is the law in the human rights context in Europe. Under the Fifth Amendment, the US Constitution, just compensation has never meant full compensation. As far as I'm aware, lost profits have never been awarded by the US Supreme Court. Now, the reason why, as so far as I understand it, and forgive me if I do get this wrong, but this is not my jurisdiction, the reason why partial compensation seems to be appropriate is that it ensures that, firstly, the government in these circumstances does attempt to weigh up the costs and benefits of government intervention, so that imposes the fiscal discipline on the government. It also ensures that private investors have an incentive not to engage in conduct which is likely to demand regulation. And it reflects a principle of burden sharing. It's not the burden completely on the government and the taxpayer and society at large, nor is the burden placed entirely upon the individual whose property has been taken. But the burden is shared between the both, which I think is entirely just in those circumstances.
Thank you, Claudia Martini.
I would like to make two comments. Number one, I think that there's no disagreement that wherever the deprivation of property exists, compensation should be paid. The problem is to define what is deprivation of property. And of course, it's clear when you have corruption. But let's go back to the case that I was mentioning. In that particular case, it was clear that the company knew the state was not making a consultation with the indigenous community. Is that a relevant fact or not? Should that be there by the company or not, even though the company was aware that the lands in which it was going to start exploration belong to an indigenous community that was never consulted. So I guess that of course is shows a situation that not everything is so clear-cut. We don't talk about corruption and prostitution, which I would say that we're all in agreement. There are a lot of other cases that are not so clear-cut. The other question that I want to raise is that we are here citing to the extensively to the case of the European system. But many of the cases that come to the exit and that have been decided lately where issues of human rights are relevant are not European cases. They are cases that come from the Western sphere. And in many cases, and I guess that will continue to happen, they relate to vulnerable populations that have nothing to do with the European system. So I guess that even though the European case law is very relevant, I think we should also take into account case law, for example, of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that have been addressing the rights of vulnerable populations, such as indigenous rights.
Well, a couple of comments. One, the issue before us is not whether the traditional law of diplomatic protection was the law that existed before the Second World War. All of us know, it's in the first book of, in the first page of every book, that only states were actors and subjects of international law. There are some debates as to whether already there have been some change in the law, but the landscape of the international law was occupied by subjects that were states. So the issue is not that. I mean, and we saw also the debate that existed at that time and why it was constructed in this way. The Latin Americans talk about that time and about the Calvo clause that foreigners could resign, if they would enter into a market, that they would sign a document or they will acquire even were forced to acquire the nationality of a country, and then, well, under the traditional law of state responsibility, it was say this is not a right you can abdicate of, because the right to exercise diplomatic protection is a right that the state has. You don't have to, this is all well known. That's not the issue before us. The law of state responsibility after the Second World War, we know. The issue before us is whether the development of an international Bill of Rights after the Second World War has had an impact on this area of the law.
And again,
we're in a university and people could have, the purpose of a university is to debate. One is there is no impact, and that's clear. Now, other people have a different view. For example, let me very briefly mention three or four things. One, there is an impact as to the subject's cover. Because if we're talking about the protection of property in the past, only foreigners were protected through the law of state responsibility, because foreign states could decide to protect them or not. You know, now, I submit here very respectfully that there has been a change because of human rights law, because the protection has been afforded not only to foreigners. And then, for example, we have the American Convention on Human Rights establishing the right of property, and we have cases concerning that. Not only the cases of Aguastingui and indigenous populations. We have cases involving the protection of the right to pension, deprivation of property, and we will see an increase of that to the extent that the region moves, of some countries in the region, from mass and gross violation of human rights, that were mainly deprivation of life and torture and basic norms of due process, to more sophisticated situations. Now there is an article and in the convention, and we will see then a change. So the answer now, I answer well, the subjects now that could act are, there has been a change. Second change, the right of individuals to operate in the international plane. Because in the past, a state might decide to exercise diplomatic protection or not because of political risk. Because in the conduct of foreign policy, economic, strategic reasons play a role,
Not every compensation was paid in this region. If we think in terms of the Mexican expropriations, expropriations that were not paid, or they were settled with less payment than full compensation. So also there has been a change in this procedural change, in the sense that individuals could participate in this type of thing. And that creates an issue also for the states to exercise diplomacy, because they could settle things. They could buy and sell for less. You know, it's again, I don't need to mention what's said. I mean, there are, if that avenue's presence, investors take a look now at issues involving the cost of litigation, possibilities of success, time, or whatever, and there might be settlements. And that I would also submit that if there is a settlement there, a state not so easily could come out and say, well, this is not your right, even if you are settled, it's my right under the traditional law of diplomatic protection. So I think that there is an impact there. Third impact, and we saw now a settlement out of court. What happens if a company recruits government officials and troops in order to commit violation of human rights so that could be extracted and they repress the domestic population? That's, we're talking there, participating in torture or summary execution or killing people. These are human rights norms. In the past, the way in which it was treated the local population was not an issue of international law. The national law was blind to that. Now, again, entering through a different realm, the law of torts, the alien tort statute in the United States of 1789, an alien can sue an alien for a tort only committed under the law of nation. We see, again, because international law is not developed just in a logical way, but it comes at in a more chaotic possibility. We see, sometimes unfairly, a proliferation of cases using the alien tort statute, but we saw a lot of settlement agreement recently where a multinational corporation paid a lot of money for the purposes of finishing the procedure. So I am, of course, because I've been in academia for a long time, a little bit more relative and more hesitant to use the category word no. I think that there is a cross-fertilization in terms of subject, objects, and so forth and so on. Not for the purpose, and the law of corruption also has entered into the realm. I think that these are good news for those who believe in the private system. I mean, we should not equate or put equal, the development of wealth and the belief in the private system to to improve it and to protect people really to everything else. But not in the 19th century, we're in the 21st century, and things that were possible then are not possible now. I think indeed that many things that were done by Latin America backfired. As a matter of fact, Latin America cannot be said equal Cuba. Mm-hmm. And I think that was perhaps for rhetorical purposes, but that's not the case. You have a different situation, and we need to distinguish. But I think that overall there have been a dramatic improvement on ethics in terms of the conduct of business, for example. And that has created conditions for the acceptance of international jurisdiction in the resolution of cases. With parallel developments, not in the chapter protection, but Inter-American Convention Against Corruption, treaties involving terrorism, ill-gotten monies, and as I said before, if I would be given political advice to a multinational corporation, and I believe in the free enterprise system, I would say, take a look also about the impact that has in local populations and so forth and so on. Some of these things are not totally crystallized, but they reflect expectations of behavior that are in the process of crystallizing in legal norms. And you cannot ignore the impact of those things. So I believe that there is a cross-fertilization.
we don't have to exaggerate the disagreement or the discrepancy between us, because in terms of what you've now said, there is no disagreement at all. You see, my point is as follows. If the investment goes into an unlawful undertaking or enterprise, then you can expropriate it without paying compensation. Now, the notion of what is unlawful changes all the time. Law is a living organism. Each time there are new crimes. And I referred earlier, you may recall, to your own example of corruption. I said, yes, there is a novelty here. Corruption is now regarded, obviously, as an unlawful undertaking. Torture is now regarded as an unlawful undertaking, no doubt about it. Anyone who will invest in, let us say, a Spanish Inquisition will, in order to facilitate the interrogation of people under torture, puts the investment on the horn of a deer, you know. It will collapse with the easiest turn of the work of the arbitrator or the arbitral award. No question about it. But that does not mean that the development of human rights, which not only do I not deny, I refer to it as an irresistible force, but it has not really affected the law pertaining to, not directly affected the law pertaining to investment. It has indirectly affected it by increasing, if you wish, the volume of activities that today will be perceived as unlawful. True. But let's not exaggerate the importance of that, because with all due respect, most investments do not go into the development of a Spanish Inquisition will for torture or for things like that. The real issues usually are much more nuanced and much more, therefore, complex. Consequently, I brought to your attention the TEDMEC decision because, you see, it refers to something which you've seen in Hollywood movies, good ones, I must say, about landfills that endanger human health. Right. However, when the investor went there, he did not go there, they did not go there with their eyes open to any unlawful undertaking. On the contrary, they were invited in. They were welcomed by the authorities. Their perceptions changed. Well, if perceptions change, the burden should not fall merely on the shoulders of the investor. That's my point. I'm not denying that perceptions have changed. I'm not saying that the right to health remains the way it used to be when the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights was adopted in 1966. We have new perceptions of what the right to health means, absolutely. But that affects it only indirectly, not directly.
Well, we have... Yes, you want to answer this?
Very quickly. I think we've got to be very careful about what we call an expropriation. If there's, for example, a confiscation of an asset acquired through the proceeds from drug trafficking, it's not an expropriation. You never get to that stage. And that's an important point to point out, because if you follow the standard test, which has already been explained in an investment treaty, it's very hard to resist the temptation for concluding that there is an unlawful expropriation because there has been no compensation paid in that circumstance. The fact is you've never got into the test because it's not an expropriation. Just to also mention how topical this topic is, as we speak, there's just been a case against South Africa that was commenced by a mining company because of South Africa's positive discrimination legislation, basically legislation ensuring that the black majority are represented in companies, both in the managerial sense and in the ownership sense. So that case has just been filed, and it's going to be very interesting to watch how that progresses. There's also a number of cases against Argentina, which I've talked to you about, I'm involved with, another case against Bolivia, where this right to water is being exercised as well. So it is a very topical point.
Please introduce yourself. Yeah.
Next three, officer views candidly exaggerated views of this body of law. And while the practitioners of this are making aware of some of the nuances that they're not trying to discuss at a panel like this, I would hope that students took some time to go back and learn where within the ranges that have been described the actual conduct, treaty conduct, and tribunal conduct, arbitrator conduct, has actually been for the past several years. And the first point, a very effective point, here in the United States, in fact, courts over and over again have granted lost profits under a Fifth Amendment taking claim. The U.S. Supreme Court has never had to address that issue because the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear this is a fair market standard, and the lower courts have applied that standard. In some cases, that has led to lost profits compensation award. In other cases, it has not, based upon the actual facts and circumstances. Same thing applies to the analogous provisions that we find in the constitutions of all of the 50 states of the United States. Lost profits have regularly been awarded by courts here in the United States as compensation for the taking of private property. Second, the arbitration awards in the last 10 years or so that have dealt with these difficult issues, I'm not aware of a single one of those decisions that has simply said private property full compensation regardless of whether the regulation was proper or not. Similarly, I'm not aware of any of those decisions that has rejected entirely the notion that there are times when regulation is improper because it goes too far. The arbitrators have spoken very difficult questions of when the conduct of a government goes too far. But there's never been, in the last 10 years that I know of, a case that simply said government conduct that deprives an investor of the value of his property is always wrong, regardless of the objective of that conduct. And the third point is that we do a sentence that we find today in the American treaties. Happens, for example, the U.S. Peru, the U.S. Colombia free trade agreements. This is a sentence that Canada in general endorses, and we find it in the Canadian model agreement. We find it in recent Canadian treaties. And there are around 20 countries that have now signed up to this sentence in their effort to find the proper middle ground. And what the sentence says is that except in rare circumstances, non-discriminatory regulatory actions by a government that are designed and applied to protect legitimate welfare, public welfare objectives, such as public health, safety, and the environment, do not constitute indirect expropriation. If the conduct of the government falls outside that sentence, then it is expropriation, and under the treaty, it triggers a fair market value level of compensation. And as to what the proper level of compensation is, as long as we all love to argue about what the public international law standard is, the treaties have gone beyond this in that regard. There are about 2,400 bilateral investment treaties today. I'm sure my brother or Professor Bolzer might actually know the exact number since they have a lot of them. The great majority of them actually write into their treaty a standard of compensation for creations, fair market value. They do not write a standard of compensation into their treaties for other breaches of different international law standards. And my favorite example is the extent to which the fair market value standard has been accepted by governments, regardless of whether it's accepted by academics. It is a treaty between Mexico and Cuba, in which Cuba agreed, in order to attract Mexican investment, that they would have to offer fair market value compensation if the Cuban government expropriated investments of Mexican investors.
Thank you for your presentation.
Respond to that? Your reference to the council sentence is very interesting. The US model BIT obviously changed quite drastically. in also including that provision from its old model VIT, which I think was dates back to 1994. And the reason it did so quite clearly, and this is the State Department's words and not mine, was that they were very concerned with some of the treaty investment treaty awards not taking into account legitimate concerns about the environment, for example. So that wording was introduced after perhaps somewhat bitter experience in practice. In terms of our tribunals either failing or not taking into account at all some of these legitimate regulatory concerns, I think at the end of the day, what matters most is the amount of compensation awarded. If they've taken into account and it hasn't reflected at all in reducing that amount, then that's really paying lip service to those legitimate concerns. And I have to say, and perhaps I'm slightly biased because of my practitioner involvement, I have to say in some of the awards that have been rendered against Argentina, one certainly detects that not a great deal of respect for some of the regulatory concerns of that country is evidenced by the awards. And one of the great difficulties I have with some of the awards is that they perceive the standard of compensation to be entirely a matter of discretion for the tribunal. And so after a finding, for example, that there is no expropriation, they go on to say that there is a breach of the fair and equitable standard, and then exercise what they purport to be a full discretion to come up with a standard of compensation, and they go on to award full compensation based on the Charles Olfactory principle, even though they have found previously that there had been no taking and therefore no total deprivation. Now, I cannot possibly agree with that development. The standard of compensation, as in any legal system, is a question of law. It's not something which is simply a matter of discretion for the tribunal. It's true that the treaty doesn't regulate it, but then that gets back to my point. One has to look outside the treaty. One has to look at customary international law. One has to look at the practice of states in order to fill in the gaps. And just to throw up one's hands and say, well, in the absence of guidance in the treaty, we'll just do as if there's been a full expropriation anyway, I don't think is acceptable. Thank you for the correction on the US practice. I must admit I've only considered the US Supreme Court jurisprudence, so if that is the case in the state courts, then that's interesting to know.
I just want to read out one sentence from a landmark decision of the Iran-US Claims Commission. It's the Phelps-Dodge case of 1986. One sentence, and it's been cited hundreds of times since then. The tribunal fully understands the reasons why the respondent, that Iran, felt compelled to protect its interests through, it doesn't matter. The tribunal understands the financial, economic and social concerns that inspired the law pursuant to which it acted. But those reasons and concerns cannot relieve the respondent of its obligation to compensate Phelps Dodge for its loss. That's the law as it stands, like it or not.
Good. Well, it's 4 o'clock. I would like to finish this panel. Let me see, there is an expression of Don Quixote that says it's better the road than the inn. And again, the purpose of this panel is to bring the issues, to talk about it, and I feel that many have a sense that they cannot think and correct things. Great, that's the purpose of it. We cannot expect anything else. We could have a panel only in international commercial arbitration, or a panel in human rights, but I think that is something very valuable in the intent, the purpose to bring these traditions and see whether there are synergies and possibilities that could enrich or not both legal venues. So I want to thank the panelists for this introduction to the issues, the participants in the audience, and invite you to a small pause, and then we will get back with the other exciting panel. And thank you very much then for your presence.